It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Got this story from a bunch of people today. This story of the strike that's been going on up in Worcester, Massachusetts for now over 200 days. You've got 700 striking nurses against this giant healthcare conglomerate Tenet, a Dallas-based company who owns a hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts, which, you know, we could spend days on why that is a bad idea. But I got this story from a bunch of people just, you know, kind of outraged. Everyone outraged at the fact that the doctors in this case appear to have sided with this massive conglomerate. They evidently sent a letter to the nurses saying, you know, basically going, oh, well, you know, things are getting bad. You really should put aside your personal wants, needs, ambitions, and come back for the good of the profession. Come back for the good of the patients, you know, because, you know, COVID's getting bad and you should really come back into the fire and basically bail us out. And you go, but here's the thing. And this is the important part of this, where mentally, my mind is in a place where the reason for this strike is what's going on there. You know, incredibly bad staffing levels, the kind of things that for decades nurses have been complaining over. This wasn't so much about wages as it was about the conditions, especially having gone through last year and all the pandemic. And then, you know, we're going to bring you back just in time to come back into the fire. And the thing that's you know, frustrating to me is at no point did I see these doctors go, the problem here is we've got a for-profit healthcare system. The problem here is we got bean counters running hospitals and not doctors and nurses. The problem is we've got a for-profit system that makes money off of people's misery. So the more people that we can get into these hospitals, the longer we can treat them, the longer we can keep them there, you know, all of this stuff, the more billable hours we can get, the better it is for the bottom line. And this is a bad system for the entire country. You know, we're told competition, competition. No, I'm sorry. There's no competition when it comes to healthcare. It's a ridiculous notion. If you're lying on the ground having a heart attack, you're not speed dialing for coupons. You're not going to be asking, you know, hey, who's got the best price on heart attacks today? When your kid falls off the monkey bars and breaks an arm like mine did once, you're not going, oh, gee, let me see who's got a deal on casts today. You're going, how do I get to the nearest place to get relief for my child? How do we get the care that they need immediately? And in those moments, you have a for-profit system that knows they've got a gun to your head. You will agree to anything because you want the pain to stop. You want the suffering to stop. But I look at this hospital conglomerate that, you know, horrible stories. I mean, just horrible stories coming out of this. Now, the nurses, evidently, from what the reporting is, and we're going to get a say on this here in a little bit, but from what I'm gathering is the Nurses Association has agreed to the last best final offer that Tenet put out, because, you know, they got to get their people back to work. But you've got now this conglomerate, this massive corporation, saying, well, you know what, you can come back, but we're not going to have jobs for you because we're keeping the scab nurses. We're going to keep the scabs who cross the picket line. We're going to keep those, and we're going to permanently replace you. And for me, this is one of those giant red flags. This is one of those things that I've been talking about for years. The only reason I voted for Bill Clinton, because he said he would sign strike replacement. So this kind of stuff could never happen. So that when you have one of these these strikes, when you have a situation where, for one reason or another, you're in this moment, that when it's over, you come back together. What Tenet is trying to do, and what companies have done across this country masterfully, is whenever there is a strike, there's maximum punishment. And this is what this is, maximum punishment. They want to permanently replace as many of the 700 plus nurses who were out on strike demanding better wages, hours, conditions. They want to be able to bring their scabs in so that if it ever happens again, they've got the scabs there as a firewall. This is about choosing new members. This is about putting new people into this to tear down the solidarity of this workplace. And look, this is what employers do across the country. And it's another one of these reasons, and I bring this up because it's another reason that we need massive, major, comprehensive labor law reform in this country. Because the employer class has had control and power far too long. And this is another one of those examples. Now, I don't know what the agreement was. I don't know what the last, best, and final offer was. I don't know. But we're going to find out here in a bit. What I do know is this seems punitive. And the doctors jumping into the middle of this saying, well, you should come back because, you know, how do they say it? We need your skills, compassion, camaraderie, and renewed commitment to provide the high quality care we have always delivered and is expected from our patients. A resolution is so close at hand, and we know you share our common goal of serving the greater good in this community. So they're saying, ladies, take one for the team. Come on, ladies, come on back. You lost. Come on. Yeah, give up that job security. Just come back because it's for the common good. Now we're going to talk common good. The last 200 plus days, no common good. Don't care. And I would argue staffing levels, something really, really important for the common good. Making sure that if I'm in the hospital, that there's a nurse, I don't know, somewhere. And she isn't so overworked that she forgets I exist because anyone would. And this is why we're in this moment. I truly believe we're in this moment of a workforce that's kind of rearranging its mindset. We're in this moment where people are saying, you know what, I've had enough of this. And I got to tell you, I'm not surprised that women have had enough of it. This kind of patriarchy is really, really, you know, it is what it is. You know, we're in this moment of, you know, COVID's getting worse in Massachusetts. The beds are filling up. The hospital cut the number of beds. You know, it's amazing what they will do to keep the scabs happy, but they weren't willing to do this 200 days ago. I mean, if you really sit down and you think about all the money that they've spent on this strike, all the money, you know, putting their workforce in their place, going after and trying to punish them. If you think of all the resources that they spent that could have been better spent on healthcare, and this is where I go back to the concept of, I want community hospitals again. I want hospitals that are run by the local community. If we're going to pitch common good to people, it should really be about the common good. From what I understand, this Tenet Healthcare has spent something like $200 million. And we're going to get a number on this, but I've been told something like $200 million. And you know, I look at this and I go, that's $200 million that didn't get spent on healthcare. That's $200 million that didn't go into caring for the people who need it. Now, we could talk about, you know, national health insurance, and we could talk about, you know, Medicare for all and for all that stuff. But what good is having that if the foundation of the system is based on, still, we got to make the shareholders happy. We still have to make, you know, the CEOs happy, the bean counters. And it's really not about outcomes. It's really not about, it's not about healthcare. And this is one of those moments where I go, you know, here's this strike that's gone on. Didn't get much, really enough attention in my view across the country because, you know, I don't think the mainstream media wanted to highlight the kind of staffing level issues that they have, the kind of working conditions that nurses have to endure. I mean, if it weren't for Twitter, you wouldn't hear a lot of a lot of the stories that have been coming out. Because, again, these are people who have been used to for decades, used to taking the abuse, used to sucking it up, and for the good of the patients. Hear that a lot. Oh, for the good of the patients. Yeah, it's a crummy job, but we show up for the patients, especially in the nursing, in the skilled nursing sector, where those folks are life and death. But I find it really just amazing that, you know, even in this moment, they want this hospital system wants their final, you know, knife of indignity. Which is, you know, we're not gonna fire the scabs. You're going to have to adjust. I got to think you're going to lose seniority. So everything that the union stands for, they're eviscerating. And because they know what that's going to bring down the road, they know why they're doing this. And again, I've seen this stuff play out in other industries. Which is why I don't think that these nurses have much of a choice but to continue the fight. And here again, we're in this moment. We're in this moment where, as a country, we need our healthcare system. We need our healthcare, our heroes. Remember, they were called heroes last year. Now they're just disgruntled, striking workers who need to be replaced. It's kind of frustrating, isn't it? And this is why I go back to, we need something like the PRO Act, or even stronger. We need workers to have a voice on the job. And when this stuff happens, there's got to be a better resolution than you're at the will of the employer. Because one of the things I've often talked about is this idea that you should have ownership over your job. You know, I know people, well, the company gave me the job. They're so good to me. They're benevolent. And you go, no, they need you. And that's your job. That's how you support your family. You should have some say. You should have some ownership of it. And this is where we need to rethink where we are. I see it happening. Look, in 2010, when I was calling for this last 9, 10, 11, saying, hey, this is an opportunity to start out of the ashes of the Great Recession, out of the ashes of the horrible Republican policies that got us into this collapse, that whole neoliberal conservative nonsense that brought us, you know, the end of Glass-Steagall and, you know, Wall Street gambling and a collapsing economy. We can build something better. And what's interesting is, you know, we're a decade away from the beginning of Occupy Wall Street, and some of the things are finally starting to grab hold. Some of the organizing that happened. And it takes me back to labor's history. You know, the 30s and 40s didn't just happen. Labor organizers had been organizing and fighting and scratching and clawing to get some bit of rights on the job for decades. Decades before the Wagner Act. So the idea that, you know, once that spark happened, when men and women were coming back from World War II and they were starting families and saying, look, we need to have better access to wages, hours, conditions, they brought the fight from overseas back onto the shop floor and built the most prosperous working class in the history of mankind. And from that moment forward, the wealth class, the employer class of this country has done everything they can do to claw that back, to take it back, because it's theirs. They believe it's rightfully theirs. So when I see this strike again, you know, I've been following this one, and we've had people on a couple of times over the last several months to talk about it and the importance of why we need to have strikes and why we need to have workers who are demanding better wages, hours, conditions, as we saw at Nabisco and Frito-Lay, and as we're seeing all across the country and in other industries. People saying, you know what, we've had enough. We have to make things better. Life has to get better. We have to have some say. Keeps coming back to just how weak our laws really are. And if we can't get something passed, if we can't get some major labor law reform done, it's only going to get worse. And we're going to return to the bad old days where everyone is at will. You know, the last couple of days I've been talking about company stores and you know, kind of the history of how we got into into the mess there and how we dug ourselves out. And now they want to push us right back. Now they want to, they're packaging it a little differently. It's coming in with a neat little bow on it. It'll be pretty. It'll be nice. But at the end of it, it's the same bad ideas, the same terrible policies. And I said from the beginning, I stand with the striking nurses. I stand with striking workers because I know in a country where you have few strikes, you have limited voice. But this, again, is one of those moments where our laws are so badly broken. The pendulum has so swung to the side of employers that they know if they're willing to spend enough, if they're willing to spend enough money and break enough rules and drag things out long enough that they can basically starve people out. That they can starve people back to work in bad conditions. They can starve people back to work in where they would give up their seniority rights, where they would give up rights. And I've seen it happen in places. It never ends well. So again, I come back to the reality. Even if you're not in a union, you've never been in one. A country that has strong labor unions. Strong, active, militant labor unions fighting for better wages, hours, conditions. You have a more vibrant democracy. You have more people who have a voice, more people who are empowered to have a voice. It seems like, and this is one of those moments where you go, it seems like this is something that the right, who keeps telling us that they believe in all those things, would actually be behind, yet what we actually find is they're not. They're the main reason we're in the mess that we're in. You think of all the attacks from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush, you know, right on through to the former guy. It's all been about stripping people's rights away, stripping their voice away, and giving more power and control to the very wealthy. That's what this is. And there are people who are standing up and saying enough, saying, nope, we're not going to stand for it. And we need that. I'd like to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. What do you think? Do you think the company should have the power to go, you know what? You lost. I won. You're going to have to do what I say. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1932. That was the day the Progressive Miners of America wrapped up their founding convention in Gillespie, Illinois. Fed up with concessions and what they viewed as heavy-handed anti-democratic rule by United Mine Worker President John L. Lewis, Illinois miners met to break decisively. Area miners were active in radical politics, and many supported currents within the socialist and communist movements. That July, Lewis opened the contract and agreed to a 20% pay cut. Tens of thousands of miners were furious and threw up picket lines at mines throughout central and southern Illinois. In Franklin County, striking miners were assaulted, shot, and beaten by special deputies and strike-breaking thugs. Many miners thought Lewis had had a hand in the violence against them. Two miners were killed and hundreds more injured. By September 1st, 273 delegates representing 40,000 miners resolved to break from the UMWA, form a new union, and plan immediate negotiations with coal operators. They drafted a constitution emphasizing rank-and-file industrial democracy. A women's auxiliary was established with Agnes Bernas Wick as its head. It imbued union solidarity and leadership qualities among non-mining women. An enraged Lewis charged dual unionism, but the new PMA alleged they represented 90% of Illinois miners. The split gave rise to the Illinois Mine Wars. Years of shootings, bombings, and assaults became almost commonplace as both unions struggled for power. The PMA soon faced internal fighting as conservatives attempted to wrest leadership from many of the founders. Though the union never dominated the industry, it continued to represent thousands of Illinois miners throughout the 20th century.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said, what looks like is going on up in Worcester, Massachusetts at this St. Vincent Hospital is classic union busting. It reeks of it. And the fact that I got so many responses from people going, have you seen this? People losing their mind over the fact that this giant healthcare company is saying, yeah, well, we'll give you something, but you're going to come back on our terms, which means we're keeping the scab nurses and your seniority is out the door. And if you ever try this again, we've got the scabs in reserve. I got a problem with that. That's why I've asked Marlena Pellegrino to come talk with us. Marlena is a 35-year nurse at St. Vincent's Hospital there in Worcester, Massachusetts, one of the 700 striking workers who today marks the 200th day of the strike. Marlena, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So am I getting this right? You guys have accepted the last, best, and final offer, but the holdup is that this giant healthcare company is saying, yeah, but one more thing, one more indignity, the scabs are staying.
That you got that pretty much right. So yes, as of August 16th was the last time, just about the last time we met with the hospital. Their last, best, and final, we were very, very inches from agreeing to that. And then they slid across the table the most vile documents that we've seen, what they call a return to work agreement, which was basically the senior nurses would be, many senior nurses would be replaced, and you could come back into a position. If it's not going to be your position, with, you know, the highly trained skills that you have, and they have replaced many, many senior nurses into areas, critical care areas like the ICU, the special care nursery, the cardiac cath lab, the emergency room, labor and delivery, all with brand new novice nurses. They basically will hire anyone to boost the numbers up in there. And it's basically retaliation for, you know, we have a legalized right to raise our voices, and we have for the last 200 days. And it was clear in their document that this was pure retaliation, punitive from one word to the other, for basically doing what we had a right to do, an assault on our union rights and the safety of our patients. It's more than distressing. I've never seen anything like it in 35 years. And, this is corporate America trying to make an example of a set of, 700 working nurses. And we want to get back to the bedside. And they're using every tactic, every unfair labor practice that they can try to break our union. That has been the goal, I firmly believe, and we have felt it in our gut. And we're standing strong. But this is a big moment. They're making this, if they get away with this, this will resonate through our state and throughout the country and the world. We haven't watched. I mean, we didn't know we'd be getting into something like this, but it's become that grave. And it's pretty sad that patients are collateral damage to this CEO and this company actually means nothing.
Well, what's interesting to me is, you know, the fact that this company has spent so much money, and I've spoken to somebody who said, you know, and I don't know if it's true or not, but they said, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million that this Tenet Healthcare has spent overall in diminished, money coming in because they've cut the number of beds, in the amount of money that they've paid out to these scab nurses and all of this stuff that they could have easily paid all of your demands and then some and still made money.
No, absolutely true. I mean, we can't, of course, you can't get a handle on the number, but it's easily over $100 million dollars and more. And they have intentionally closed 111 acute care hospital beds in the middle of the surge of a pandemic, solely for the purpose of putting pressure on nurses to cross a picket line. They are now causing harm to our entire community. And there's no length that they wouldn't go to get what they want, which is to break us. That amount of money, I mean, less than that amount of money, we could have had. This is not about our contract. Our contract had been settled a long time ago. We shouldn't even be on strike just for standing up for. We just need more bedside nurses at the bedside to care for our patients. That's literally what we went on strike for. We just need more nurses on the floor at the bedside, which is what you should be doing as a healthcare corporation. We're standing up for our patients saying, hey, it's not safe. We need a couple of more nurses a shift, basically, and a few other things. That's what it comes down to if we want to get really simple. And that's what this company has done in order to just prevent us from having a legalized voice at any time. it's very, very scary. The patients are the, we went out on March 8th with our patients as our number one priority, and we remain out on strike 200 days later for the same thing. And now this company has, they're using this opportunity definitely to exploit. You know, they see a group of nurses. Obviously, we worked through one pandemic. They figure we're very weary. They think we're weakened. I think they underestimate the power of nurses in general and the integrity. You know, obviously, it's a female-dominated profession. And I think that doesn't go unnoticed. When you want to try to exploit, they see an opening they think they can take. And it's just pure evil we're staring down.
Yeah.
I'm going to be very honest with you.
Now, what caught a lot of our listeners' attention is this AP story that evidently a doctor or a couple of doctors sent your union a letter basically saying, okay, you took the contract, you got what you got, now come back, forget all that other stuff, you know, put your patients above everyone else, put everything above your own interest. It's time for the community, how they put it, with the recent elevation in COVID-19 status in our area to level 3, long wait times in all area hospitals, the need to have all beds staffed and open. We need to be there for our patients now more than ever. It's time for you guys to come back. We need your skills, compassion, all of this stuff. But here's the thing. Here's the part that I don't see you guys as the problem here. It's Tenet Healthcare who is now at this last minute going, well, we'll give you the contract here, but you're all fired. Seems to be a kind of a big sticking point.
Yeah, it's pretty big, and it's pretty unsafe. And what we say to our colleagues, the doctors, and our other colleagues in that building who have stood by while we've been on the sidewalk for almost 7 months, is that urging, that imploring, you need to take that to Carolyn Jackson. She's the full obstacle, the one obstacle that stands in the way of close to 700 nurses streaming back into that building. We want to work at St. Vincent Hospital, not under these conditions, and not until our contract is settled, not till our unfair labor practice charges are resolved and this toxic work environment is gone. But, the doctors and other employees, they have been fed a lot of anti-union propaganda over 7 months and more. And I'm not sure if the doctor actually wrote this letter himself. There's been others that come through. Every time there's pressure on Tenet and Carolyn Jackson, they try another union busting tactic, which is to use shame and guilt and try to deflect the responsibility. The responsibility lays directly on Carolyn Jackson and Tenet's shoulders. They are putting our community at risk, and all of our colleagues should be up in arms. We want to be at the bedside. And when she gives us our jobs back, we say to the doctors and our other employees, we will be back in that building doing what we do best when right. We get our positions back.
So now he writes in this, a resolution is so close at hand, and we know you share our common goal of serving the greater good in this community. And, maybe it's just me, maybe I'm a little sensitive, but, overwhelmingly, I got to imagine the 700 nurses are mostly female. Would they ask this of a man? I mean, this seems to be kind, and maybe it's just the time we live in and I'm hyper aware of it, but I don't think you would ask, a bunch of guys striking for this kind of, put your own stuff aside, even though nurses do overwhelmingly put their own needs aside, but saying, we need you more. The community needs you more than you need your seniority rights, than you need your job back. It just seems a little, I don't know, a little pat on the head kind of thing. Or am I reading too much?
No, you're not reading too much. Right along, being in a female dominated profession my entire life, I love being a nurse, but this is something we have fought for years, and we've made headway, but there's always that patronizing. It's a little pat on the head. Be good little girls. And we have some men. So I say that I often say that, especially with this, their return to work agreement, it was basically, you little girls were really bad, and now we're going to come after you, and now we're going to punish you. And it's really sad that it's 2021 and we're still fighting this. But I don't believe any male dominated union, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, we have obviously many male nurses, and they're great, and we love working with our male counterparts, but there's no getting away from this is a female dominated profession. And I don't believe any male dominated profession, Teamsters, trades unions, which do have women, would ever be put under. It's the shame and the guilt and the, you know, your needs don't come above anything else. We always put our patients first, but we are workers and we are union workers. And there's nothing wrong with saying that. You know, the hospital doesn't like to hear that. Oh my goodness. Yes, we are proud nurses. We are proud union members. We worked very hard to win those rights 21 years ago. And it's another way for large corporations to diminish the voices of nurses, diminish your union rights, and basically negate your concerns. And I think they've been very surprised by the fact that we would take this step and we remain out on strike this long. And the more, the stronger we become, the dirtier their tactics become. So yeah, it's pretty distressing because at the end of the day, we're not working in a factory, though Carolyn Jackson, the tenant, likes to run the hospital like a factory. There are human lives at stake here. Humanity is at stake here. And that they would go to this length and not come to their senses anyway, it's illogical. And in my view, I question the sanity of the people that are running these companies. Is it purely greed, power, and ego? Probably. But I think that this particular group has become unhinged at this point.
Yeah, it is greed, power, and ego. And that's basically what it is. More for me, less for you. So, you know, as a 35-year nurse at this hospital, what are you expecting to go back to? Because, you know, I don't know if you were able to address the staffing levels in this contract, if the last best and final offer has anything to address those concerns. Because, you know, I've heard horror stories from people in the nursing profession, pandemic forward, how bad things are getting. So what do you expect going back? If you get to go back, what do you expect the conditions to be like if you weren't able to address those staffing levels?
Well, our main goal and what we're sticking with is none of us are going back until we all go back into our regular positions. And that will be the case, and we will maintain our strike, and we'll maintain what we're doing until we reach that resolution. That's the only resolution to end this strike. When we do get back into the building, those of us who want to remain there, we feel that we will be able to stabilize that building. It's going to take a long time. They have literally destroyed our St. Vincent Hospital brick by brick. I think I know that even from non-nurse colleagues inside who stay in touch with us, they say, Marlena, you would not recognize it. It's like total anarchy. And St. Vincent Hospital, as we know it, is gone. But we are a strong community of nurses. I think the reason we've been on strike so long is we actually do think of ourselves as a family. This is a over 125-year-old Catholic-based hospital. There's a lot of devotion. And the last, best, and final does have staffing improvements that will enhance our ability to care for our patients at the bedside. Otherwise, we would have never talked about agreeing to it. It does not address every single need of our staffing, but we made huge progress, huge improvements, going on strike and maintaining that over these last 7 months. So we do feel that once we get back in there with the contract as it, if we do get to sign it as a tentative agreement, as long as we all get our jobs back into the positions that we previously left, we do feel that we will be able to stabilize and start to care for our patients. We know that it's probably going to be pretty horrific, but many of us feel that, you know, this is our home. Even this is not Carolyn Jackson and tenant's home. They actually have a guest in our home. We felt that for a long time. And whether they stay or not, it's the nurses and the employees that have that really make the hospital what it is. So if we can get back to our positions, the staffing language that we have achieved so far, that we will sign off on when we get our jobs back, will enable us to care for our patients better. And then, you know, there's always contract negotiations that come up, and there's always ways to go. But I think that, we are committed to that. We are committed to getting back to the bedside and doing what we can.
Now, as I understand, in the coming days, you've got some events planned, some community building, because ultimately, you know, this is going to come down to community support, I hope, which, you know, as I've been, talking with people, the community has been backing you guys pretty substantially.
Amazing. It's been humbling. I mean, it's 200 days, and even before the strike, I mean, we've had everything from our interfaith community, candlelight vigils, four or five of them, many events and rallies. We've had every legislator, state and city legislators, Congressman Jim McGovern. We had Senator Markey, Senator Elizabeth Warren. We had the opportunity, you know, very spontaneously about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks, to visit and talk with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. I mean, it's been amazing. All of them have been completely supportive. And this Saturday, we do have a community solidarity event that they're hosting for us right on our picket line. All of the other unions and labor organizations come and support us on our picket line, our other nursing unions. It's just been amazing how people have pulled together. And I just came off the picket line a half hour ago. A random woman pulled her car aside. I'll just say this, we were filled with tears. She looked to be about in her 60s. She was very quiet, very meek looking. She handed me an envelope. She said, I want you to take this to the strike office, give this to the nurses. I said, oh my God, thank you so much. She didn't want to give her name. She pulled away and I opened the envelope, a crumpled white envelope, and there was $1,000 in it. Wow. And this did not look like this woman could afford $1,000, but she wanted that to go to, she said, do whatever you can with this to help the nurses. And, you know, there were quite a few of us on the picket line. It really touched us. You know, when you think, you know, people are trying to bring you down, we know the hospital is, that's the light right there. People understand the truth, the community understands, and it's very, very, it's very humbling, and it's very gratifying to know that people get it, that we're out there. We're out there for them. We're out there for our community.
The idea of one day longer, applies here. I wish you guys the best. I wish you the best in the event this weekend and drawing more community support. Hopefully Tenet comes around and does the right thing, because they could end this immediately. You could be back to work tomorrow. This could all be over. It is their, as someone, tweeted out to me, they're the a-hole here. Not the nurses, not the community. It's this Jackson woman and Tenet Health. So I wish you the best. Keep up the great fight, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks very much. Thank you for having me. It was great.
Thanks so much. Marlena Pellegrino, a 35-year nurse there at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester, Mass. Seriously, they could end this tomorrow. Could be over. And they choose not to. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1906. That was the day that Dr. Harriet Louise Hardy was born in Arlington, Massachusetts. She pursued a career in medicine, driven by personal family tragedy. She lost her father to pneumonia when she was only 4 years old. She also lost a baby brother to the 1918 influenza outbreak. Dr. Hardy became an early leader in the field of occupational medicine. She was also the first woman to become a full professor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Hardy began her career in occupational medicine when she began to investigate the causes of illness among workers making fluorescent lights in factories north of Boston. Many of these workers were women. Dr. Hardy researched the cases of berylliosis in Lynn and Salem, Massachusetts. The metal beryllium is used in the making of the lights. Inhaling dust or fumes of the metal can be deadly, but symptoms often do not begin to show up until years after exposure. Symptoms include shortness of breath, coughing, and scarred lungs. Dr. Hardy developed the National Beryllium Registry. It was one of the first registries of its kind to track the impact of a chronic health disorder. Her research helped lead to safety measures in the handling of this dangerous metal. Dr. Hardy also worked with unions, including the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union and the United Mine Workers, to identify and address workplace health hazards. These included substances like lead, mercury, anthrax, and asbestos. She wrote a textbook on the subject of industrial toxicology with another pioneer in the field of occupational health, Dr. Alice Hamilton. Dr. Hardy helped to forge new ground in making job sites more safe and healthy for workers.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it seems kind of fitting, given our conversation, that big money again has thwarted the will of the people. And the story today over at Salon points out that they're reporting that Kyrsten Sinema has taken $750,000 in donations from pharmaceutical and medical device companies. Oh, look, campaign cash, little fill in the coffers. You know, gonna be a tough re-election for her, given the last year that we've seen out of her. And look, what they're saying is, you know, giving Medicare the ability to negotiate lower drug prices would save money for Medicare, and that those resources could be used, you know, elsewhere, help get Granny some, you know, some new hearing aids, maybe some chompers, maybe some glasses, you know, something, some life improving kind of things, instead of just lining the pockets of the pharmaceutical companies. Now, what they're saying, and this is this is what's being reported. They claim, according to Politico, that Democrats estimate that the being able to negotiate lower drug prices, you know, doing the things that they need to do through this Build Back Better plan, would save over the next decade $450 billion. $450 billion, and pay for a big portion of what, you know, Biden's plan is, you know, to get, you know, expand health care for families, you know, to expand health care for seniors, for children, paid family leave. There'd be a lot of things that we could begin to do to help people stay healthier. And it seems like a good idea, but no. We're going to have to give those $450 billion to the pharmaceutical companies. Let that sink in for a second. And again, I go back to something that my grandfather, and I've said it a bunch of times, so if you're tired of it, tough, because I'm going to say it again and again, because it's true. If a rich person's going to take a buck out of their pocket to tell you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because they understand return on investment. And wow, is Congress a great place for return on investment. They spent $750,000 and are going to get $450 billion. You know, here's the thing. That's six zeros. That's a lot of zeros, man. $750,000. I mean, you write it out, right? And just put it in your mind. You know, $450 billion. You think of all those zeros. $750,000. That's the return on investment. So the two for one that my grandfather was talking about, you know, that they're going to make something off of it. Oh my gosh. I mean, this is greed on steroids. And this is an industry that they believe they're entitled to it. Because, well, we've got the drugs. You need us. And yet we pay for most of the drug. We pay for most of the drug research through our universities and through grants and through the NIH and through all these different ways that we foot the bill. This vaccine, we raised a ton of money, a boatload of money to get this done. And it's really bizarre to me that, you know, the people who seem to be concerned about the debt and the deficits are the ones going, no, we're not going to take it. Because Bill Gates had access to it. I'm going, when did Bill Gates have it? Never mind. But understand, this is what's really frustrating me about our healthcare system. Because it's all about the money. It's all about the greed. And look, I understand. It's America. America is a for-profit company. We're open for business. If we can exploit, if we can cheat, got to do it. And if you do it big enough, you know, people build buildings after you and museums, slap your name on stuff. And it's one of these things where it's not even, and this is the part that's frustrating to me. It's not even that it's, they're trying to hide it anymore. And I like, you know, on the internet, every once in a while, you see somebody comes up with the, you know, they need to have NASCAR jackets. And I got to be honest, I'm not too far from the idea of let's mandate NASCAR jackets. At least we know up front. Because going through some of the filings, the donor filings, that's a long, arduous. There should just be running totals. You know, you should be able to go to a spot like, you know, NASCARCongress.com or something. And you just click on a name and right there you see all the sponsors in a running kind of real-time thing. And maybe you get some jockeying and make a game out of it. I mean, while democracy is swirling down the tank, might as well have some fun. Yeah, I've been saying this about billionaires forever. We should have billionaire trading cards. We should be able to choose our favorite billionaire, the one who's cheating us the most. And yet we get these politicians time and time again. You know, I was sitting here thinking, you know, is Kristen Sinema, is she the new Joe Lieberman? Is this the new Trader Joe? Because Trader Joe is the reason we don't have anything decent for healthcare. Look, the ACA was a major step in the right direction, not taking anything away from it. It was what, at the moment, thanks to people like Joe Lieberman and Max Baucus, Max Backdoras, they were the best, most possible we could probably get at that moment, given the people who were there. But it's why we don't have something better than the ACA. It's why we're struggling to hold on to that. And it's why people are angry. Because it wasn't great. You know, we were promised hope and change. We were promised we're going to get health care. Our families are never going to have to worry about going bankrupt again. We're going to be able to see a doctor and not worry about going broke. And yet here we are. All these years later, a Republican Party hell-bent on pay or die. That's their alternative. They haven't come up with anything else. And some corporate Democrats who keep going, well, you know, we can't upset the apple cart. I got funders to keep happy. And I know, don't make Kristen Sinema angry, because she could become a Republican. She could. But what the hell's the difference at this point? Because you're not getting anything done. This is the part that drives me insane. You're not getting anything done. And if they don't get this this Build Back Better plan somewhat funded, if they don't get some of this moving, next year it's not going to matter, because they're not going to be in the majority anymore. And I look at this and I go, you know, who in their right mind would be against lower drug costs? Now, we've got a different plan. We've come up with a different plan. And there's some moderate House Democrats who've come up with a different plan. And that plan doesn't do nearly as much. It's window dressing. It's the kind of window dressing that makes you go, see, we did something. We got something. A little bit. Just a touch. Now, granted, it's not anything that we really need. It's limited the number of drugs that we could actually use. But politically, we can say something. And my problem with that is eventually people realize that they've been duped, especially when they go to the drugstore and they go, what's different? Or worse yet, they lower some prices and raise others. And now you've ticked people off. And I understand this idea that you have to balance the needs and the wants of different groups. I get that. But I'll tell you, I'm a little tired. I'm a little tired of big pharma, big healthcare, big oil. I'm tired of these special interests constantly at every turn, getting every one of their wants, one of their wet dream lists, everything all with a neat little bow on it. And then the rest of us having to foot the bill and suffer. It's really quite remarkable that we've put up with it this long. And it's no wonder people are angry. It's no wonder people are upset. But thanks to people like Kristen Sinema, you know, we're in this moment where no matter what side of the political aisle you're on, you look at this story. You look at this story and you go, we got a senator who took $750,000. And then, oh, gee, we're going to mysteriously, you know, now, was she going to oppose the bill anyway? Probably. Because she's probably been in that pocket for a while, because they put her in there because of that. And I'm fully cognizant of that. I'm not saying that this one $750,000 series of donations, this was what put her over the edge. No. They put their people into places to make sure that they're well cared for. And the one thing that Donald Trump did tell the truth about is that, you know, he would buy all politicians. He funded them all so that he'd have a piece of all of them when he needed something. This is what corporate America knows better than anything. And it's part of where I think we, at some point, have to get to a publicly financed election cycle where we ban corporate contributions. We limit the amount that people can give to a small amount. And we undo some of the laws that we've allowed to prop up around these groups that, quote unquote, do education. When we know that they're coordinating with campaigns, when we know that they're corporate-backed front groups, when we know that they're right-wing hack think tanks, when we know who they are. And look, it's both sides. It just seems that the right has more money. Because, well, they're willing to literally let you die. I mean, think about the healthcare thing for a minute. Think about the argument that the Republicans have made. We're going to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which is, for millions of people, the only lifeline they're going to get. There's nothing else. We're going to repeal that and have nothing in its place. If I remember right, you know, Trump wanted to give out a discount card or something. Would you go, really? We're going discount card? Yeah. It's quite remarkable how easily duped we are. I mean, I look at the healthcare front. It's amazing. I talk to people one-on-one. Nobody is happy with their employer-sponsored healthcare, except for my union brothers and sisters. And they complain that it's too costly. And I would agree. You know, the amount that they pay for the best healthcare money can buy is really expensive. But my union brothers and sisters, they've got the, you know, if there's a Cadillac standard, you know, there's beyond that. If there's a gold standard, it's platinum. It's well beyond what we think of as premium healthcare. Most people have high deductible plans with co-insurance. So not only are you paying the deductible, but you're paying a portion of the bill overall because it's co-insurance. You know, with all kind of co-pays and all kinds of nonsense, restrictions. And then they pay through the nose for it. You know, I was talking to someone the other day, works in a local warehouse. And they were saying for the family plan, for a good family plan, it cost him, for his family, $250 each and every paycheck. That's $1,000 a month out of his paycheck. Now, this is a guy who only makes, you know, somewhere around $18-19 an hour. So when you stop and you think about it, you're looking at he's paying more than a quarter of his wages in healthcare costs. That is insane, considering we're not supposed to spend more than 30% of our wages on housing. So he's literally paying for something he hopes he's never going to need at the same or higher rate than what he's paying for his rent. And you wonder why people are upset. Now, Trump said he was going to come up with a plan that was going to be really cheap. It was going to be universal. Everyone's going to be covered. It was going to be fabulous. It's going to be great. We never saw any plan. And I had joked at the time that we knew what the plan was. It was a ream of blank pages stuck in the secretary's desk because there's no plan. Because Republicans don't have a plan. Their ideas are the failed policies of what got us to this moment. So when I talked to Marlena Pellegrino earlier, and I hear the stories of what's going on with the staffing shortages and the kind of over being worked and the kind of controlled environment that they have to labor under, you go, no wonder we're in the situation we're in. No wonder people are angry. How do you get a 35-year nurse to go, you know what? I don't have a choice but to go on strike. I mean, stop and think about the courage that must have taken for her to go, look, the only way I can help protect the people that I'm in charge of, the only way I can, with a good conscience, go in there and give my all is to know that we've got the backup we need and we have to take a stand. And to me, the criminal in this is the company who forced this and are still forcing it. But again, it's not about healthcare. It's about profit. It's about money. Everything is at this point. And you go, when do we change? When do we have that moment? Now, I've had some interesting conversation with people who think, you know, and I hope they're right, that we're at a moment, like an inflection point, where we look around us and go, what? Kyrsten Sinema took $750,000 and then voted against the pharma bill that would have helped millions of seniors get lower drug prices? And nobody's, you know, outraged over that? We have a healthcare system that's you know, they're looking at the quarterly profits more than they're looking at the outcomes of their patients, especially during a pandemic. We don't have the capacity to treat all the people that we need, so we're going to shame nurses to put themselves in danger and their patients in danger just so that some doctors can feel better. We're in really bizarre times. And I keep coming back to, politically, we need champions. We need heroes. We need people who are willing to speak up, step up, and do the right thing. We need leaders. And sadly, we're not in that moment. At least I'm not seeing it. Now, look, I've had some insider friends say, Rick, relax. We're going through some spasms. It's going to be fine. Going to get the Build Back Better plan passed through, going to get the bipartisan infrastructure bill passed through. We're going to invest in the country. Your children are going to be okay. We're going to address climate change so they're not going to roast when they're your age. Going to be okay. We're going to be okay. I want to believe that. But I look at stories like this one and it just makes me wonder if that's even possible. You got to wonder on a certain level. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. President Richard Milhouse Nixon issued the Philadelphia Plan. The goal of the plan was to require building trades unions to admit black members into their ranks. Nixon believed this would show him as a civil rights supporter without having to give in to the more radical demands of the civil rights movement. Affirmative action opponents sued to kill the plan, but they were unsuccessful. Prior to the introduction of the Philadelphia Plan, construction unions nationwide were almost exclusively white. Throughout the 1960s, black workers organized to demand access in construction trades in many northern cities. In Philadelphia in 1967, black workers protested to integrate construction work. This led to federal attention and Nixon's plan. The plan required six Philadelphia building trades to create numerical goals for integrating their locals. They had to meet those goals to get federal contracts. Many white construction workers nationwide opposed the plan. Construction workers in Pittsburgh and Chicago held protest rallies. In practice, Nixon had very little interest in strong enforcement of his plan. He wanted to use it to defend himself when critics attacked his administration's civil rights record. Civil rights leaders saw through Nixon's charade. Real progress in desegregating construction work was very slow, and the Nixon administration did little to change that. Still, Nixon's plan was a step, however small, at integrating the building trades. Another important step was the founding of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists in September of 1972 in Chicago. Today, the organization has members in more than 1,200 locals and works to increase and support black members of trade unions. Today, integration of the trades remains an incomplete project.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.